It's hardcore history.
Addendum.
So last October 2019, right around Halloween, I was in Toronto to do a promotional event for The End Is Always Near, the book I got out last year. And I went to the theater and I met the guy who was going to be the interviewer. It was a Q&A setup, which works really well in these kind of environments. And I sat down and just had the best time for a little while before the actual event, getting to know Canadian broadcaster Jeff Merrick. If you don't know Jeff, it's probably because you live in the United States or somewhere where he's not. Well, he's a hockey savant. So, you know, knowing about hockey or being in a country where hockey's important might help. Jeff is a host on Rogers Sportsnet. He's a co-host of the 31 Thoughts podcast, and he's just an awesome guy. And we hit it off right away, and then we went on stage. And I do these things from time to time, and most of the events, you hear the same questions over and over. And Jeff had just great questions, different questions. He knew my stuff. He'd done his homework. We just had a great time. And I said afterwards, let's not lose touch. And he got a hold of me a couple months later and said, you know, I've been looking on the internet at some of the interviews you've done over the years, and I just think you have a free show or two of your own you could just crank out really quickly if somebody just interviewed you, you know, maybe on your Hardcore History Addendum feed or something. And I said to him, I said, listen, it ain't always that good. It depends on the questioner and all these kinds of things. And I basically told him, you know, it was great in Toronto, though, if somebody wanted to do it again. And long story short, Jeff was willing to get roped into this a second time. And long story short again, if you don't like this program, remember, Jeff works at Rogers Sportsnet, and there's probably an email you can get in touch with him to complain on their website. So, Jeff, that's my thank you for hosting this and being such a good guy. All the complaint mail goes to you. So let me just tell you that this was a coronavirus-inspired program, meaning we did things a little differently than normal on both ends of the interview. So there are a couple of digital glitches or dropouts. I apologize. There was no way to fix them. So you'll notice them in there. Also, I have some conversation for you, a few notes, a few updates, and some teases maybe even at the end of the show. So without further ado, Jeff Merrick returns, and hopefully only the second out of many times in the future, to discuss whatever the heck he wants to for the next, what, hour and something. So Jeff, take it away. Today, you're the host.
You know what I wouldn't mind talking about to kick it off, Dan?
No.
I would like to talk about the title of your book, which I love because I was a huge Doors fan. Now, true or false, The End Is Always Near is a tribute to Jim Morrison and the Doors.
Well, I think the broad answer is true. I wanted to have, I always like those books that have sort of the, in italics, a quote or a famous phrase or something to lead off each chapter. And so at one point in my book design, I was going to have one of those leading off each chapter. And I had the Jim Morrison line, "The future's uncertain and the end is always near," before finding out how expensively copywritten that whole phrase was. But so somehow, as these things tend to go, you know, somewhere down the line, these things find their way back in a transmuted form or another. And the fact that it became a partial title of the book is a little bit surprising, but that's how it was originally going to be. And so in a roundabout way, the answer is yes.
Because I was a huge Doors fan as well. And I think, you know, for a period of time there, that was pretty much all that I listened to. I was fascinated with Jim Morrison. It was an on-ramp to a lot of poetry, a lot of literature, a lot of brainy, geeky kind of stuff. And the music was fantastic as well. And it made me appreciate something about myself with music. Perhaps you're similar, I'm not sure. Things that have a brooding undercurrent, I find that I really enjoy that type of music. I've always believed you can write in two separate moods. You can write in either bloom or you can write in brood. And for me, the Doors, as far as American bands go, whether it's Riders on the Storm, The End, or even The End Is Always Near, which is just a great bar tune at the end of it as well, had that element of brooding. And that's why when I first saw the book, Dan, I said, okay, this is going to hit me where I live. Carlin gets it.
You know, this is why I'm flashing back to our conversation in Toronto, because you asked the most interesting different questions, because normally when you talk to people and they ask questions, you get the same ones all the time. And sure, Nobody ever asked me about things like music and stuff. But boy, I feel exactly like you do. And I want to add something. It's not even the, I'm going to add a different emotion to the brooding versus the blooming. A friend of mine used to say when we were growing up, he said that he was a Pink Floyd fan. And he said that there was something about the rhythm of Pink Floyd's music that synced up with his internal heartbeat or his rhythm or something, right? And I remember thinking that it would had to have been turned up to like 78 speed on my record album to have synced up with mine. And so I always gravitated towards something that was Iggy Pop said he had a heart full of napalm instead of a heart full of soul. And so, yes, I like the darker stuff, but I like the Stones, Give Me Shelter, right? If you go look at the Rolling Stones, I always tell people, go online, look at them in like 1971, 72, live in that era, 1970. To me, that sounds like a punk band, right? It's very stripped down. It's very, I mean, it sounds like what it really is, what punk really is too, what the Doors really were too. It's a stripped down kind of rock and roll where the brooding slash edge comes through, and there's and I should say this isn't as much with the punk stuff as with the Stones and the Doors, but there's also a little bluesy thing going on there too that I think really ties it together. And so in answer to your question, yes, when I was a kid, there was a lot of music that was popular in the 70s, Peter Frampton, Foreigner. It didn't speak to me at all. And so yeah. I went back and listened to the stuff that you're talking about. And then when the stuff that was similar in sort of tone, feel, vibe came again with 77, 78, 79 and the punk and the new wave stuff, that spoke to me too, the same way that Nirvana and all that grunge stuff spoke to the people who liked the early punk stuff.
See, but I think what we're talking about too is sort of music, and you've written about this and you've talked about this on various podcasts as well, this idea of studying behavior at the extremes. When you stretch the elastic to the point at which it can no longer stretch, you know, what's the behavior around that? And I've always been fascinated with that as well. And I see that, you know, this comes out in, I think we have a mutual admiration for the sport of boxing, for example, sports like MMA, these types of events, where really, and I've always wondered, you know, why am I attracted to things like boxing? Why am I always attracted to Shakespearean slasher plays? You know, Titus Andronicus, heads rolling all over the stage, blood all over the stage, and I am king, curtain, and that's a, like, why am I attracted to that? Like, I'm a, you know, pretty left-wing leaning kind of guy. I mean, I'm a typical Canadian, you know, always looking to apologize and make accommodations for everybody. Where does that come from? And I find myself in a situation where I think I'm attracted to events and sports and situations that exist without metaphor, where everything you say you want to do is what you want to do, everything you intend to do. Like, there's no, you know, in some sports, they'll say, oh, yeah, I really want to kill this guy. Well, no, you really don't. But then there are sports where you really kind of do. Like, there are sports where that metaphor doesn't exist. It is a metaphorless environment. And I think maybe that's why I'm attracted to music that speaks there and sports that speaks there as well.
There is, I pulled it off of my bookshelf just now. There's a Latin phrase I read, and I hope it's true. It's one of those things I've learned in my line of work not to just blithely quote or assume any quote is true. So I always disclaim it a little bit. But it's an inscription in Latin that says, it will give you pleasure to look back on this scene of suffering. And it's about sort of the love of history, kind of, right? The fact that isn't it weird that people like you or people like me who are such, you know, I like to think of myself as sort of a humanist, right? Why would I enjoy seeing scenes from history involving suffering? Why would I enjoy watching Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier at the Thrilla in Manila come as close to death, as Muhammad Ali said, as he'd ever been? Why is that interesting, entertaining? Why would I go back and watch it again, right? I mean, what is it about our character? I had a professor, the late, great Robert Poise at the University of Colorado. He's famous there. They planted a tree after he died. He had said almost the same thing you did. He said, why? He called himself a lily-hearted, bleeding-heart liberal. And he said, why would a lily-hearted, bleeding-heart liberal like myself be so fascinated by these right-wing, strongman, dictatorial? He was like a Nazi history professor in terms of what he focused on, Bismarck and those guys. And he questioned himself, why am I interested in this stuff? I don't think we have an answer, but I do think there's the wonderful side of it where we can enjoy it like that Latin inscription says, look back on this play, and not have to be a part of it. It's the same sort of vicarious thrill we could have at the time where I wrote my book talking about how strange it would be to live in a pandemic and how science fiction-like that might be, and oh, wow, can you even imagine? And then to have it happen, where you kind of go, oh, yeah, I much more liked the theorizing back in the day when this was a theoretical than I do now.
And now we find ourselves, you know, all, you know, various Edward Hopper paintings, or at least that's how we feel right now.
It is bizarre, isn't it? It's bizarre.
But the interesting thing about it to me, and again, you know, we're all on quarantine. You know, I'm removed from my job and surrounded by my family 24 hours a day, and I love it. I'm not so much sure that they do, but you know, I look at this and I say, is this bizarre? Is this weird? Is this freakish? Or have the last, I don't know, 150 years been the freak? And is this just sort of what reality always has been, and now it's caught up to us? I don't know the answer to that.
I think that's exactly what I couldn't have phrased it better myself. I think that's exactly. I think to paraphrase, I think it was Samuel Huntington when he said the end of history. We've been living in a break from a rhythm that our forebears knew so well. And here, and this is the part that is hard to get your mind around. As crazy as everything's been, they never had the luxury of only having one bad disease out there, right? When they had all the bad diseases you can think of, they had all the other bad diseases at the same time. So you didn't just have cholera, you had smallpox. You didn't just have plague, you know, you had typhus. It was all there together. And you had measles and mumps and all the childhood diseases that killed you once upon a time. So I think about this as the tiniest little taste of what it used to be like, and I sit there and shudder, because look at what it's done to us with just the tiniest little taste. And maybe you could say that the reason it's done this much to us is because we haven't been accustomed to feeding on this sort of problem for a while, and maybe you grow a little bit more calloused and a little bit more resilient, or maybe your systems become a little bit less fragile over time if the disease rate's higher and more lethal than it traditionally is, like now. On the other hand, it is a, you know, what I said in the book, people are saying all the time, you know, I had an Israeli reporter to me the other day say, is this helping book sales? As though this is a good thing, right? We have a pandemic, and I was talking about it. But, you know, every major thinker, expert, I mean, heck, Bill Gates for the last decade has been saying something like this was coming. What I think's fascinating from the history side of it, though, because all I did in the book was pick out these historical situations to show sort of how humans have behaved in those circumstances before, and that seems remarkably instructive for sort of how we behave today. So that's the part that's kind of interesting, where you go, you know, times change, medicine evolves, but we human beings are about as panicky and predictable as we've always been in groups.
That's interesting about that comment, you know, how is this helping book sales? And I think of the old Carney saying, what we lose on the swings, we gain on the roundabout, through all of this. You mentioned resiliency there a second ago. When we were in Toronto together, we talked, you and I, about the difference between, you know, Canada and the United States, and where the United States is more based on an ethic of conquer. Canada is traditionally based more on the idea of survival. And I do wonder if what we're seeing right now is a clash between business and institution. And always the default has been business can solve this, business can get bloated, only necessary things, chop it right down to the bone. I mean, business hates excess. It's all about bottom line. It has no time for something like institution. Institution is slow. Institution is bloated. Institution is a waste of money. But right now we find ourselves in the situation, Dan, where it's the institutions that are probably going to get us out of this thing, not business. And we're starting to see that clash each and every day. I wonder how, I really do wonder where this one ends up. And if at the end of all of this, there's more of a premium placed on not chasing speed, not chasing a fast dollar, but maybe we slow down a little bit. Maybe we're a little bit more deliberate in what we do. Maybe we think a little bit more about our choices. I mean, right now we're looking at, I think, this battle between efficiency and endurance. And right now, what we need more so than efficiency is that type of institutional endurance that business has always had nothing but contempt for.
I think that's a fantastic analysis. I said to somebody else recently, too, we were talking about maybe the way something like the current situation we're going through makes us simply reframe the lens through which we view some of this stuff. So whereas a business institution running a hospital might see a lot of ventilators that no one is using and a lot of hospital beds that are empty as waste, at a time like now, that looks more like insurance. And when you look at the costs of what we're going through now, it looks like relatively cheap insurance. But that's simply something that comes into play as part of the, I would call it the give and take. My stepfather's metaphor for it was a tug of war. And there's a tug of war. You called it the institutional side. That's a good way to put it. And the business side. And they're pulling, right? They're both pulling in opposite directions. And sometimes I would argue we've lived through, and I don't think I have to make much of a point on this, an amazing growth stage in terms of the information revolution, the 1990s, the 2000s, the phones, the texting, the social media, the whole thing, right? That's a giant, huge boon on the business side of things with institutions playing catch up. So imagine that tug of war leaning heavily toward the business side of things for a while. And then the realities of existence, like plagues, coming into play to force some correction on the institutional side of things, pulling the rope back towards the center a little bit. If only because one is theoretical. On the business side of things, you can push, maximize profits, maximize gain, maximize stock price until something stops you. Now, that could be the market. That could be your own business model. That could be what it is you sell not being desired anymore. Or it could be a black swan event like what we're going through now, right? Or a 9/11 attacks or anything like that where all of a sudden, okay, you have to stop and think for a while. Your momentum, your forward momentum is slowed for a reason. And you have to ask yourself whether or not this is a temporary break on things and we can continue to do things just the way we did after a slight pause. Or whether, as you were suggesting, this is a lesson, right? And the lesson is, let's not get caught again. Let's build in some resiliency, some redundancy, and some ability to counteract what this plague we're going through right now has exposed in terms of our systemic fragility, maybe is a good way to put it. So I think I would make the case that there's always the balance between the institutions and the business side of things, and that it's been slanted toward the business side of things because the pace of change has been such that it would be crazy, I think, to imagine the institutions keeping up with it. You know, I mean, they inherent, and by the way, not just that, but they inherently move more slowly because, I mean, the pace of change on the business side / tech side of things, I'm not sure how brick and mortar things can keep up with it. So I think maybe what you're suggesting makes some sense, at least from the vantage point where we can see it here in the midst of it. It seems like it's exposed something where you go, well, let's not get caught without enough ventilators again, you know, things like that.
And then what becomes of us at the end of all of this is another question. You know, Elliot Friedman, who I do the 31 Thoughts podcast with, his grandmother always had the best saying, "You plan, God laughs." Like, we all have an idea of what this is going to be at the end of all of it. But I can't, Dan, help but feeling like as we all try to, you know, figure out who we're going to be when all of this is done, I kind of feel like we're all sort of, I don't know, kittens chasing laser pointers for information here. What did the medieval map makers always write when they had, unknown territory? Here be dragons. We don't know. I just can't help but thinking that there's this area that we're all headed to where here be dragons. It's a great question. And what are we when we go through this? You know, calm waters make poor sailors. Is this like, how is, we know we're going to be different people at the end of all of it. We know our technology is going to be different. We know how we consume, what we consume, how we live is all going to be different. How are we going to be different people? My gut on it, Dan, is to say that we'll all understand how interrelated we all are from person to person and also person to nature. You know, you look at the tree outside your window and you realize, oh, hang on a second here. Now that I've really had to think about my health for the last 12 months, maybe now I do understand that half my lungs are hanging in that tree. I'm guessing that we have more of an appreciation how everything is joined, how everything is linked. But again, I don't know because here be dragons.
We did a show long time ago now, old style, hardcore history, short, light by modern standards, where we talked about the Great Depression. And there was a quote that we used by New York Times economic writer Robert Samuelson. And the gist of it was that we make fun these days, or economic experts make fun these days, of the stupid, silly mistakes that the money experts back in the Great before the Great Depression era made, right? We laugh at their stupidity and their naivete of markets and all that kind of stuff. But his point was, before you get too haughty about it, realize they were doing the best that they could with what they knew at the time, and they got blindsided by something they didn't see or know about. And that can always happen again. And of course, after Samuelson said it, we got hit by the dot-com crash and all that kind of stuff. The point being that it's always something that you can't see coming that's going to get you, because if you can see it coming and you can plan for it, you know, it's a lot less likely to hurt you. But those things are reliably out there. That's the black swan idea, right? That you don't know that something's out there, but you can imagine that something out there that you can't plan for is going to hit you. So, like you said, and God laughs, right? So that's what your idea about the fragility and all that sort of stuff comes into play also when you're talking about excess hospital beds. The excess hospital beds are not there for no reason. They're there in case. So when you say changing us, that right there might be an example of how it changes us. In the same way that the headstrong rush towards business moving forward might get slowed by the reality of something like a plague, people's forward thinking and continual momentum toward the next goal, I think, takes a hit here, where everybody is just forced. My kids are at home. My kids have they can't do anything but just think about kind of, and try not to think about what's going on here. I would make the case that there is some value in thinking about things like this. And especially if you want to get into stereotypes about generations, you know, always looking at their phone, 5 seconds of attention span, never thinking about deep subjects. Well, they're thinking about deep subjects now, if only because it's affecting their day-to-day existence in a way that just, it preempts thinking about other things. Would I have wished this on us in order to get that benefit? Of course not. I'm going to give the commencement speech at my alma mater in like a couple of weeks, and the whole point of it is to try to point out that there might be some good sides to this, but I'm not saying I wanted it, right? I'm not glad your commencement was canceled. Don't get me wrong, kids, but if it's going to be canceled anyway, maybe there are some side benefits. And to answer your question sort of at the end of it, a little bit about, you know, does it change us? There's a chapter in the book, and we did a podcast on it. Do tough times make tough people? It sounds like an MMA style phrase, doesn't it? But I don't mean it that way. It literally is just the same thing one would wonder about seeing in the animal kingdom or the plant kingdom, or any sort of like life's reaction to adversity. And I mean, if we're this adaptable species, right? If that's the number one thing we bring to the table, we don't have sharp teeth, we don't have long claws, right? We're the smart ones who can adapt like coyotes. Does adaptation require adversity, like you said? If it does, then this is this is going to be something that helps create a more formidable generation down the road.
Yeah, you know, there's to extend that, you know, there is that feeling that at the end of all of this, we're going to see in this tough situation who got tough and who cut the laces on their shoes when the fight was about to start. You know, there's, you know, we talked about, you know, why are we so attracted to these brutal dictators? Why are you so attracted to, you know, the macabre? Why are you so attracted, you know, to behavior at the fringes of the extremes? When you're, you know, a pretty, you know, middle of the road kind of person, maybe left leaning, maybe a little bit of a humanist, a little more understanding, someone looks for similarities instead of differences. You know, just because you're a pacifist doesn't mean you don't appreciate the value of passing the fist, is something that I've always maintained. And I think in this situation here, you know, and other generations have gone through it before. And you're right about you laughing at these, you know, kids playing Fortnite all the time. And, you know, the closest thing to a fist fight is a nasty tweet that they send to someone in anonymity on a eggshell Twitter feed. But I think at the end of this, we're gonna find out, you know, whose spine got hardened through all of this. And, you know, you're going to find out, I think, through all of this, who can endure. Because I know I keep coming back to this, the Margaret Atwood survival issue, or the Margaret Atwood, you know, survival aesthetic here. But, you know, we're going through something that is not just physical, but is mental as well. And already we're seeing people that have, you know, completely abandoned themselves and everything they believed in or perhaps prepared for because they want to get back to normal quickly. And there's an attractiveness to getting back to normal quickly. And I understand that all too well. You walk into the front door of my house, there's two kanjis, and it's a Japanese saying, it's a Taoist saying. It says, unlearn something daily. And I really feel that one saying, Dan, more than anything else, has helped me in my life at every single stage. Unlearn something daily. And I think if we're going to survive through all of this, and if anyone's going to survive through all this, I think we need to unlearn things from the past, because this is all going to be different. As we mentioned, the media is going to be different. The way we go shopping is going to be different. The way we greet each other, is that it for handshakes? Everything is going to be different. And I really think that one of the keys to survival with all of this, if we're going to get tough and not cut the laces, is to start unlearning things as quickly as possible.
Being the cynic that I am, I want to know what you mean when you say the people that are going to survive this, the people. I mean, let's define the term. What is a person who doesn't define this or survive this, or a society that doesn't survive this? In your mind, what does that mean?
That's a great question. I think people that can come out at the end of this and can still have, how do I say this properly here? I don't want to offend anybody. Surviving both literally, and I also think surviving and still being able to work within a society, still work within a group of people. And that doesn't just have to be immediate. That can also be online, but still, you know, what did Nietzsche always say? When you fight the monster, it's important not to become the monster at the same time. At the end of it, not become the monster. What's a great Twilight Zone episode? The Monsters Would Do on Maple Street, you know, where it's never about the monsters. It's about how we treat each other.
I love that.
That's always been a big lesson for me. It's my favorite Twilight episode, Dan. And when I say survive all of this, you know, survive in the sense that we don't turn on one another. You know, we have this ritual in my family now. After the day is done, our 3-year-old goes to bed, and I stay up with my 10-year-old and my 8-year-old, and we watch Walking Dead. I've never seen the Walking Dead series before, so we've started at episode 1, and we're now plowing through the 5th season. I don't know if I should be showing my 10 and 8-year-olds The Walking Dead. I'm not sure I'm going to be on the cover of next month's edition of Today's Parent magazine, Dan, but it's a nice tradition that we have. And the one thing that I've learned through all of it is the lesson from that Twilight Zone episode, which is it's not about the zombies. It's about us. And the greatest threat comes from us. If we can come out and survive this, by that I mean if we can still not turn on one another. On the last Common Sense podcast, you talked a lot about partisanship and what partisanship is doing to us. And I couldn't agree more with the points that you were making, because at the end of this, if we can't get along, if we can't all survive with one another or come up with some, and it doesn't have to be like this Matthew Arnold idea of, you know, Elizabethan England is the absolute, you know, model of how things have to be. We have to come up with this idea of, we have to come up with a way that we can all get along with one another and not let this tear us apart, not let that monster separate us from one another. I hope that makes sense.
It does. And I think tough times are points of a fracture. In other words, one of two things happens. They bring you closer together and heal some of those things. I mean, you have a war and everybody unites, you know, in a common cause and forgets their partisan differences, for example. Or crisis can make the fault lines larger and fracture them more. I mean, we see that too. So this could go, things like now could break in a number of different fashions. When I have conversations with people, people get angry with me. After the last Common Sense Show is a perfect example. And for those in the history audience who don't know, I've done a current events podcast for longer than there've been podcasts. I was doing it when it was a radio show. It didn't used to be as hard as it is now because everybody is so angry that trying to find this ground that Jeff's talking about where you can actually try to talk to people who disagree strongly about things with each other and speak to both of them tends to get the same treatment that a police officer showing up at a domestic violence quarrel with a drunk couple runs into, where they might have been trying to kill each other 5 seconds ago, but the minute the cop tries to come in and bring peace to the situation, they both turn on him. So that's, I kind of feel like the cop in the domestic violence situation sometimes, but moments like now are tests. And so when you say we have to be able to get along, because I keep asking myself, what's the alternative? I mean, I tell everybody, regardless of where you are in the political spectrum, you're not going to win. Now what? And that's where we are. If you can't think of the now what, then you're planning for some, I don't even know, you're planning for a perpetual political war that will continue long after you're gone. And what did it get you? Maybe that's short-sighted, and you know, but at the same time, I'm looking at it now going, I'd like to save reality a little bit, because when you jump off the edge in terms of going off the deep end with, say, political realities, I mean, it's funny, we have a plague now in a sense that we haven't seen in a very long time. What if we started to see political outcomes of the sort that seem to be the things that are consigned to your history books, right? What if all of a sudden those didn't seem so strange and abnormal and out of the blue? Let's try to avoid that, shall we? At least that's kind of how I try to think about it. And that sounds like you, and I think a lot of people who form what I would consider to be sort of the ballast of society, these people that might want reform, might want change, might disagree with each other over specifics, but sure as hell want to keep the boat intact.
What do you think happens with technology and all of this? You know, last time we were together in Toronto, we talked a lot about Marshall McLuhan and the idea that, you know, technologies have these hidden agendas. You know, they shape the way they shape the user in ways that the user never would have imagined. You know, we see major events, you know, dictating, you know, what type of media gets consumed and how it gets consumed. Not that I want to couch this in wins and losses, but I do wonder what type of media wins here. You know, we think of the Vietnam War and we think of television. You know, we think of, you know, the first Iraq War and we think of cable news. In this situation, Dan, what wins? What comes out of it in your estimation?
I obviously think a lot about this, I consider myself to have a tiny little bit of responsibility in making it worse, maybe, because in the 1990s, late 1990s, I was working in a company I started with some friends, and one of the things we were pushing was amateur content, and one of the ideas behind this was some of the idea of how it was going to change news. And I thought it was going to be something for the better. It was going to be opening up news to all sorts of views and opinions and journalists and reporters on the ground. And you didn't have to be, you know, I was a reporter and I was saying you didn't have to be a reporter to report on a news story. You just, all you have to do is, at the time I was saying, have a tape recorder or a camcorder and take it out there and record what's going on around you. And I thought this is going to democratize news. But you know, it's funny. It's got me thinking about a lot of things, including something that I'm uncomfortable with. I was thinking the other day, not to jump around, but it's such a multifaceted issue. I was wondering about the value of a shared view of reality, even if the shared view of reality wasn't true, right? Is there a so like if you're having the water cooler discussions and it's 1975 and you're in an office in Los Angeles discussing what you read in the news that day, about 85 to 90% of the people around that water cooler are going to accept the same facts from the New York Times and the Washington Post and the nightly newscast and Walter Cronkite or whatever and all those people, not in 75, but you know what I'm saying, maybe in 75. But now a person today might say, well, you know, that was a bunch of BS and they didn't know what was really going on here and there, and they might be right. But there was a shared idea that about 85 to 90% of the people had on reality, which allowed them everything from the ability to debate things, to have, I mean, it was something that passed for truth. It's like the fiat money people always tell me, you know, the money you hold in your hand is just paper. The only thing that matters is how much stock people actually put into it, right? Because you believe it. Well, the same thing was true of reality. It always is true of reality. You believe it. But if 85 or 90% of the people believe on the same reality, you can kind of work. It's a fiat currency of its own, right? It's information fiat currency. What we have now, though, is nobody believes the same reality. We're into these camps where we're all reading different stuff. And the first thing you say in a discussion with anyone is you question their sources. This is a democratized news environment, but it's also a democratized truth environment. And I'm finding that this is a situation that I'm not finding good historical analogies to use as guideposts on how something like this might go. It's a fascinating human experiment. I don't know how to navigate through it myself.
Yeah, I remember Jello Biafra once said, "Don't fear the media, be the media." And that's always stuck with me. And I think that that hits where you live when you're talking about creating amateur content and democratizing media. You know, it's interesting when you talk about, you know, look, okay, so what, you know, where are you? Are you left wing? Are you right wing? You know, what are your media biases? You know, what's the old journalist saying? If your mother says she loves you, get confirmation. It kind of feels like we're at that point now, with all of it. I'm curious, because, you know, that point about having a, you know, if 80% of people are on the same page about history, about current events, and there's an accepted media, there's an accepted version of the news that we all agree upon, then we can have the conversation. You know, I think that that has really done a disservice to television now, because it has demonstrated the limits of that format, and by how an hour is divided in TV time. Because as you well know, in every segment you have between 6 to 8 minutes to speak. And unless you go along the same lines as those that have come before with all the basic assumptions, if you try to paint outside the lines a little bit, you spend the entire segment trying to explain the premise of your point without actually ever getting there. And that's why I think, honestly, and I know that I'm saying this on a podcast, I know that I have a podcast myself as well, but honestly, I see as far as the big winners through all of this, I think this is going to be, because I still believe we live in the golden age of audio, I think the big winners of all this is going to be podcasts. I really do. I think at the end of this, this is where ideas can get, can, you know, like a symphony, you know, the melody can rise and can fall and can come back again and can turn into something else. And you aren't limited by the authority of time, or you aren't limited by a certain programming format. I think, you know, really at the to be self-serving here, considering I do have a pod, I think that this is going to be yet another moment where podcasts demonstrate that this is the ultimate media to consume right now. And of course, not all podcasts are created equal. Not all podcasts are the same. And yes, I do understand that, you know, right now we look for, you know, we have these biases. We only want to, what's the line? Nobody wants to hear other people's opinion. They just want to hear their opinion in different sounding voices. that's kind of where we're at right now. But I do think that this is the place where, you know, the revolution will not be televised, right? The revolution is on podcasts. And I really do believe that this is going to be another brick in that wall for pods.
I hope, and this is the hope, I hope that deep conversation and in-depth looking at things the way, you know, a lot of podcasters like to do it, by the way. I mean, when you have a three-hour podcast, you have time to go into depth on issues, right? I think that it's a little like vegetables, even to some kids, where if you give them cake long enough, even some of the most anti-broccoli-oriented kids start going, you know, a few carrots might be okay right now. I mean, maybe it's like it's there's a pendulum swinging back and forth, or there's always a segment of humanity that craves. This is the other possibility, that we're all created differently, and there's always a segment of humanity that craves looking at things through a different lens, a higher zoom perspective, or a more granular one. You know, it's a personality question. And so something like that, rather than the 5-second quick hit, appeals to them. I always said one of the great things about podcasting is it is a giant pie of listening audience size. And if you appeal to just a tiny little sliver of it, that can still be a heck of a lot of human beings. And that allows you to pick some topic that might be extremely narrow, that 90%, you know, 90% Mexican science fiction comic books from the 1950s or something, right? But the small segment of that slice of the pie that finds you may be a huge number of people, and they're all going to be fanatically cult-driven like folk because they've been waiting for someone like you their whole lives, you know? I think podcasting has innate advantages over that. I also think, and this is just, I find this all the time. You know all about this too, Jeff. And by the way, your insider stuff on the industry is absolutely dead on. And we can go there if you want. I'm sure there's a lot of people in the audience who are actually in the industry, so they would understand it too. Sure. But I would like to point out that there is a huge difference between creativity with a large group of people and creativity with a small group of people or a single individual. You and I were talking before we started here about how interesting it is to watch all the late night talk show hosts do their coronavirus at home versions of their shows without the lights and the camera angles and the glitz and the band and the audience and the whole thing, and they look remarkably like the rest of us, which makes some of the better podcasters who do similar stuff to them look that much better by comparison, right? When you take away all the lights and everybody's equal, those guys might be funnier. So I think maybe your point is well taken. I think there, last time I heard, there were 750,000 podcasts. So there's really something for everybody. And what I do love about it, it is a natural place for genius talent to be found. Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, any people who are like great talent, Robin Williams, none of those people today would have had anywhere near as tough of a struggle as they did in their day, because they would just have to have a podcast and everything else would take care of itself from there. The talent would move mountains.
You know what a lot of it is too, I think, Dan? Well, first of all, there's going to be a whole new star system that's created through all of this. You know, once everything is equal, then, okay, it's the best ideas, it's, you know, the best shows, it's the most creative people, it's the most engaging, thoughtful people. Those are going to be the ones that end up coming out shining at the end of all of this. I think one of the failings of media right now is this idea that everything needs to be multi-platform. Well, you know, we'd love to on-ramp this television show. How can we repurpose it as well? How can we repurpose it as well for radio or for podcast? And you can tell the difference. I mean, I know you of all people specifically know the difference when you are listening to a radio show that's been podcasted versus doing a podcast. And even though it's subtle, the difference is huge. Radio, and you talked about this on the last Common Sense, and you're bang on, this idea of heat, and yell and scream and choose, you know, confrontation over conversation. That's going to get those people that generally on their radio will only be listening. You know, what's the average TSL for the time spent listening for a radio listener? Like, if you're lucky, 6 to 8 minutes while they're in their car before they get out of the car to do something else. You just want to capture that one slice. That doesn't work for a podcast. That doesn't work at all. One of the things that I think a lot of people have always appreciated about either Common Sense or Hardcore History, and I try to do on every podcast that I'm part of, is the respect and acknowledgement that you're broadcasting, generally when you're doing a podcast, right into someone's ears. And the last thing that people want to hear in their ears is screaming and yelling. And that's why I think, as far as, you know, what's going to be that media that helps to define this generation after this pandemic is all done, I think it's going to be the medium that chooses conversation and is easy to listen to. And to the earlier point, has the best ideas, has the most, you know, interesting observations, and is easy to listen to and doesn't scream at the listener. You know, radio is generally broadcast into a car, so you're still broadcasting to the back seat. Television is broadcast into a living room, right? There's still that old theater idea of talk to the person in the last row. Podcasts go right into your brain. They should be listenable and quiet and not jarring. That's what I've always believed.
Jeff, I'm going to try to not assume that this is some sort of passive aggressive attack on me personally, because I am well known for going in a nice low tone of voice and then all of a sudden screaming in the ear of the listener. That is almost like one of my known traditional styles. So I'm going to take this as a personal slam against me and my approach to podcasting, because I'm known for doing that. And listen, this is a good time to address the issue, because I did a virtual reality thing, a World War I exhibit in Skywalker Sound. George Lucas's company did the sound, and they were nice enough to have me up to their facilities in Northern California, gave me the grand tour. I got to meet the staff, and when I met the staff, one of their real fantastic, great sound engineers comes up to me, says, "I'm this big fan. I really want to tell you how much I love the show, blah, 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 blah. Have you ever thought about using any compression on your voice, though? Because just get, you know," I came back, and if there's a Ben, I told him, I said, "Well, everybody's still talking about the compression issue." And just so everyone knows, in radio, when you're on the air at a traditional station, they have compression, which is, you know, it squashes your voice between the highs and the lows. They have it for all sorts of reasons built right into the soundboard. So it's nothing you think about. When we got off radio and we got the freedom of podcasting, it became like new, and Jeff, you'll understand this, it became like new audio colors to paint with. All of a sudden,
yes.
You know, and I was always in the VU meter red anyway, right? So I was never a good boy anyway. But all of a sudden I had these, you know, with the compression giving me sort of a light pink or a pale blue, all of a sudden I had dark, angry blues and bright reds. And now the downside of that is you could clip a little bit with the software, you could bother people's hearing or whatnot, but the ability to go soft and low and high and loud and mix it all together, those are the tools of a traditional oral storyteller in any society around the world. And so we do some compression, but every time people want to push for more, I keep thinking, I become the selfish PV artist who doesn't want you messing with my most extreme colors in any direction. You know what I mean?
It wasn't a slight. First of all, because one of the great things about what you do and how you couch all of your podcasts is you do all that. My main point was this wall of sound in radio that we normally get, which is, you know, scream at people for 5 or 6 minutes to capture their attention and ignore something, which I think is perhaps one of the most important things in either radio or podcast, and that's silence. You know, what's one of the great things that can get people to lean forward right now? Silence.
Oh, yeah. Silence is a note, right?
That's a great, wow. That's a great way to phrase. It is a note.
And I didn't make it up. I think that's a musician thing. I'm not taking credit for that.
That's a wonderful, I got to write that down. Silence is a note. But I mean, it's like, when I listen to your podcast, the one thing that I appreciate is that you use all those different paints and all those different brushes, but it's not overwhelming. You know, it's well-placed. Like, listen, there's nothing wrong with a great scream. That's fantastic. I don't know that I can take 5 minutes of it when I'm trying to listen to someone's point or trying to learn something here. But again, this goes back to part of the earlier conversation we had to talk about, you know, blooming and brooding. You know, these two things, what do the Taoists say? They arise mutually. That which is explicitly two is implicitly one. They go together, so you need both. I think where a lot of radio tends to go wrong, and certainly talk radio, which is the background that I'm from and you're from as well, there's this idea that we only have them for 4 minutes. Make it loud, make it aggressive, really grab their attention, because they're not going to be in the car long enough to hear you. And oh yeah, we've got to get to traffic, and we've got to get to weather, and we've got to get to the stop set.
Oh, well, I mean, no argument there. I don't hold anybody accountable for that. That's the format. And within the format, as you said, you've got, you know, this is what was, and I always, when people ask me about podcasting, I always talk about how attractive all the creative white space was. Because when you come from radio or television, as you said at the beginning of our conversation, you have these little blocks where you can be creative, and there's 6 minutes or 4 minutes or 8 minutes. And then somebody gives you a podcast and you open up and you look and it's just a giant, big, complete white space. And my whole early career was listeners helping me to understand that white space was even less constrained than I thought it was. I mean, I always say that we issued an apology to Hardcore History listeners on the show the first time we went over an hour long, because it just seemed like some horrible transgression, you know, on their time. And they would write back and say, and obviously this is the very early years, but they would write back and say, we have pause buttons. And this became a way for them to teach me the unlimited size and scope of this white space that we were working with. There's no limits at all. And so once you do that, I told years ago, I mean, we were probably into podcasting only about a year and a half before I turned to somebody and I said, I can never go back to radio again. I said, I can never go back to radio again because, one, I lose this white space. And two, how you know this too, Jeff. Every radio station I've ever worked in, you have a map. And on that map is a bunch of concentric circles emanating from your transmitter showing you how far the broadcast signal reaches on a map.
Yep.
Podcasting is global. I mean, North Korea may not hear us, but I mean, if I do a show about Iran, I'm going to get letters from Iranians and emails from Iranians. I mean, it's... I could go to New York, which is the number one radio station market in America, and it would be like a downgrade in terms of who could hear me. So when we talk about podcasting being the better medium in terms of format and what it gives you in creativity and depth and all those things we talked about, how about just the old-fashioned metrics? You can reach more people, which is what the advertisers and the radio station owners and the broadcasters always cared about the most, too.
You know, it's funny. I was making that point on a previous podcast a few years ago, and someone sent me in an Edward R. Murrow quote, and it was perfect. I always love these moments where I get grounded from listeners. And she said, what was the quote? It's Edward, because your voice goes across the world now doesn't mean you're any wiser than when it only went to the end of the bar. And it was such a wonderful, such a wonderful, like, oh, wow, good for you. You've got a podcast. People are texting in and emailing in from Australia and all over the place in Sweden. Let's not forget, this doesn't make you any smarter. It just means your reach is that much longer. The only other big event, sort of historical dividing event, Dan, that this generation has gone through was 9/11, and couched in the area of media and what we're watching and what we're consuming. I can recall, you know, September 10th, the headline stories were still shark attacks, and then 9/11 happened, and somehow sharks stopped attacking people. But do you remember what the big television shows were pre-9/11? Was travel shows. I mean, every time you turned on the television, it was travel. Go here, go there, this wonderful voyage, this exotic place. It was all travel. And even on radio, you know, a lot of travel shows, all, you know, sponsored in order to sell you various trips. But it was travel shows. And then after 9/11, it seemed as if, Dan, that entire industry, that travel show industry was over. And it all became about home improvement. People stayed home. People nested. People feathered their nest. That's what they wanted to do. That's how they felt. I'm too scared to go anywhere right now. I'm going to take care of this little plot of land and this pile of sticks that I've sort of cobbled together here and call a home and try to make it as nice as possible because the world out there is really scary. Again, I'm going to ask a question. I have no even remote clue what the answer might be. But what do you think we'll be interested in at the end of this pandemic, whether it's 6 months, 12 months, 18 months from now? I mean, I think programmers are all asking themselves the exact same question. I'm pretty sure we'll all take more of an interest in our own health. But I wonder what we're going to be consuming, like as far as, you know, people that watch television, listen to podcasts. What do you think people are going to want? I mean, they wanted travel shows pre-9/11, but after 9/11, the last thing they wanted was to travel.
Well, I might not be a historian, but I can sure hedge like one. Let me give you some examples of how it might go. So it kind of depends. The first big variable is how quickly does this thing go away, right? So if this coronavirus is significantly better in 2.5 months, then this chance of simply trying to bounce back and return to some level of normalcy seems more likely to me. I think that's the natural human desire, is just to get back to the way things were and forget this ever happened. But, well, one, obviously that's going to be hard to do for people who've lost their jobs and businesses that have gone under and all that kind of stuff, right? But If it doesn't go away like that, if it goes away more slowly, or if there's several reoccurrences and respikes, say when the weather gets cold in the Western Hemisphere again, things like that, well, then this is going to be more of a scattered thing, more of a, no, you're not going to be allowed to just pretend this never happened. You're going to really have to make this part of your long term. You're going to have to build this into your thinking long term. You know, you don't, my family is so beset. The news, the it's funny with the bad, not to change the subject, but the bad news itself begins to get to people after a while. And the way that the media sort of is always weighted towards whatever is going to get the most eyeballs, extra, extra, read all about it. The bad news right now is what people are interested in. So you're seeing a predominance of disaster. And it doesn't mean it's not out there, but it's what people are getting. And so I think there's this desire for bounce back. I don't know if the nature of this virus is going to allow for that. And I think if it doesn't, that's when you're going to see the changes that you were talking about more, because we're living in a new world and that you just have to, right? So like the media thing we were talking before we turned on the recorder about your new reality, which is like my old reality. You're all just podcasters to me now, Jeff. Even, all you professional guys, you don't know what you were missing being able to work from home in your sweats, and now you'll never go back. They'll never have you back. They don't have to pay for those free croissants and donuts anymore. No insurance, no liability. You just work from home, Jeff, and I'm going to make you work twice as hard. But I think that this is going to be heavily dependent on the way we come out of this. I do think, and I always feel this way, but this is sort of, I'm a devil's advocate person. So when things are good, I'm always a doomcaster. When they're bad, I'm always a silver lining guy. But this has always been the idea behind there's a capitalistic idea that when times get crappy like this, you remember Ray Arcel, the great boxing trainer, and he had a line. He said, hard times make monkeys eat red peppers. And it was basically because monkeys won't eat red peppers unless they have to because they're starving. So the idea here being that there are going to be a bunch of people that will find, and I don't mean to sound unicorns and rainbows about it, but this is true. There's going to be a bunch of people that find their path to success in life right now because they have to. Because something that might have been comfortable and easy is no longer comfortable and easy, and they have mouths to feed at home or whatever it might be. This does not legitimize or make okay or ameliorate the suffering of all the other people that don't do that. But I'm suggesting that this is all part of how people individually are going to respond to their own circumstances, and how we respond as a society is going to depend in large part about how all of us as individuals do. And that's going to depend in large part about how this damn virus leaves us or doesn't leave us. Does that make sense?
It does. And I wonder if, too, if we start to see, and not this, you know, Shakespeare, for example, you know, wrote King Lear. During a pandemic, you know, a pox on both your houses, Romeo and Juliet. I mean, all this type of speak is all something that William Shakespeare was going through. And a lot of this great, a lot of Shakespearean tragedy was, you know, written in the time of a plague. But I wonder if at the end of this too, or through this, to your point about people finding out what they should do and charting a new path and discovering more about themselves and figuring out where they should be going and solving that finally. Considering that there are, there are ways that we live, and then there are reasons why we live. And now that we're all in quarantine, it's a lot more about music and art and books and paintings and poems. Like, we're learning a lot about the arts, and perhaps we're realizing too that as much as, you know, we chase the dollar every day, you can't live without the arts. And I think people are realizing that this is, you know, one of the reasons why you stay alive more so than ever. So I do wonder if at the end of all of this, there will be some type of creative renaissance, because doesn't that normally happen, Dan, when we're all asked to look inside as opposed to just chasing something externally? When we look inside of ourselves and, you know, realize, you know, what's in our hearts and what's in our minds and how do we want to express ourselves, and now we have the time to do it, doesn't that generally lead to some type of artistic renaissance?
Oh, my answer on this is going to be multi-pronged, because the first thing is yes, I absolutely think that. I think it's a great thing. Art is one of those things that some people are born appreciating and some people really learn to appreciate as they grow older. And I fall into that category more and more, and really understanding, first of all, the timeless nature of it. I mean, Cicero, I think it was, who said, you know, writing is the only true form of immortality. Art is a form of chasing immortality, of having a piece of you, the artist, live on in some way beyond your mortal existence, right? This is why it's a complicated answer, because I don't want us to smudge or besmirch the purity of creative art with money and finances and personal gain and all that. But I'd like to point out, and this is something that I tell college students. I have two children who lean toward the creative rather than the engineering side of the temperament also. And what I try to point out is, when I was a kid, everybody would try to talk you out of the creative pursuits because they thought you were going to be waiting tables at some restaurant and that was going to be the end of your life, and you were going to, you know, you're going to be on welfare because you spent all your time with a theater degree from some school. But I try to explain to my kids now, look at the enormous amounts of money that people who create in the entertainment world get. I mean, I always say, J.K. Rowling, look at, how's that for a good idea? How many people have made the living of their entire lives off her idea, right? So that's the power. I mean, Tolkien, look at all the, now I'm picking individual, but this is what I say, if you are creative, that is ground zero for everything everybody else in the entertainment world does. All the lawyers, all the attorneys, all the agents, all the cameramen, you know, and you know, it's funny, I had, there was a South Park episode once, and I'm going from memory here, so I hope you'll forgive me. It's not a South Park episode. It was the making of South Park, and they showed you how they made it, and they showed the facilities, and they have this place where all the artists who do it and everything are playing ping pong, and they have a green room, and they're all, but there's only one guy. It's Stone or Parker that comes up with the actual ideas, and because they're on a tight schedule, and because it's all out of his head, nobody can work until he comes up with the idea, and so the camera follows him around the hallway, and you can just see this look on his face, like, I've got to have an idea, I've got to come. Everybody's waiting for an idea, and as he passes by the green room, everybody in the green room stops and looks out into the hallway to go, you know, has he got an idea yet? Because nobody can do anything but play ping pong until the guy who is creative gets the engine humming with the ideas. And so what I point out is, yes, we can all be unpublished poets in our house with the coronavirus going on and be inspired, and that's fabulous, and we need it, and it's beautiful, and it's artistic, and it, many of the greatest artists of all time fall into that category. At the same time, let's not pretend that it's not a great way to get ahead in life. These days, the people that make the really big money are the showrunners. You know, those are basically the writers. The people who come up with these ideas, the people that have, I'm going to use the term IP, the intellectual property, come up with intellectual property. Who comes up with intellectual property? Do lawyers come up with intellectual property? Do agents come up with intellectual property? You need all those people, and they're all creative and they're all wonderful at their jobs, but nobody works until the South Park guy comes up with the idea. And so what I always say is, the creative people are the genesis of the entire entertainment industry. And so to think about it as some job where you're going to be waiting tables and wasting your college degree, to me, seems ridiculous. You're going to be out there, J.K. Rowling, you know, J.R.R. Tolkiening up the place, right? And so in my mind, this is a great opportunity for a bunch of people who, because of their jobs, never had time to sit at home and work on their poetry or their music or their play that they're writing or their YouTube video play on the, I mean, do it now, right? It's a great opportunity. What are you doing? Take advantage. Might change your life.
You know, I can recall very specifically. Do you remember a guy by the name of Jim Rose, Dan?
Yeah, vaguely. Who was he again? Wasn't he like
table
guy or something?
Jim,
right?
Jim Rose Circus. The Jim Rose Circus was that grunge.
Then I'm not thinking of the same guy.
No. So Jim Rose was the architect of something called the Jim Rose Circus. Toured with Lollapalooza, grunge circus, crazy things. Guys getting darts thrown into their backs. You know, various piercings, lifting weights from different body parts. It was like a chaotic circus that you would imagine traveling around with, you know, Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails. And so when I first started my career in 1994, It was me and my buddies Bob Mackowitz and George Strombolopoulos, and we're doing a late night show on Friday nights in sports radio, which had nothing to do with sports. And we got to spend an entire afternoon with Jim Rose, did an interview with him one and a half hour. Then Jim and I went out for lunch. I was a big fan of Jim Rose, still am. And he said something to me that always stuck with me. And there's no right answer to it, but it's a place that everybody sort of comes into conflict. There's that choice moment. There's two paths, which way are you going to go? We're having lunch, we're having a cup of coffee, and he said to me, so you're just starting your career, right? I'm like, yeah, but I'm not sure about this, if it's going to work out. You know, I still have these, you know, dreams of going back to university, chasing a PhD, who knows? And he said, well, if you decide to chase this, if you decide to go this media route or whatever route you take for that matter, realize one thing as you begin. There's going to be a place in your career where you're going to get to a crossroads, and we all get there, but just be aware that it's coming. And here's the crossroads. You're going to have to make a decision whether you need to quit or work harder. And there's no right answer, and there's no obvious answer, and you won't know if it's the right answer until many years later. Should you quit or should you work harder? And I wondered now, in this situation where people are forced away from their natural existences and their natural, to further to your point, this is your opportunity to do this. This is a chance where you don't have to face this dilemma, right? There's two types of freedoms in the world. There's a freedom, you know, there's a freedom to do anything, and there's a freedom from having to choose to do anything. And right now we have more of freedom from having to choose to go out and do work. I wonder if through all of this right now, to your last point, Dan, this is the opportunity where you don't have to face this dilemma of quitting or working harder. It is wide open for you, to your point. Go for it now. This might be your best opportunity.
Well, and I can say from a personal side, the hardest thing for me, young as a younger guy, was when somebody would say, okay, after you've worked hard all day at your job, right? I was at KABC in LA, for example, working on the assignment desk. After you've worked hard all day at your job and you come home exhausted, then put time into your side gig, right? And I always thought, oh my God, that's so hard. I have nothing left. And I especially don't have the best of me left, right? And so I always found that to be so hard. This is the opportunity, though, to do that. I always said boredom is a wonderful motivator to go do something. And I always thought that's kind of the problem with the kids that I have. I mean, they think they're bored, but they're not bored like we were, like little rascals bored. Like, you know, I was throwing anvils off of my garage door roof onto a board that I'd set up on a fulcrum to imitate something from a cartoon I saw. That I left a dent and a chip that's still in the Toluca Lake sidewalk in front of that house I haven't lived in 40 years because we were so bored. We were just trying. But my point is, from that boredom stems a bunch of stuff. And I can think of a bunch of things I did throughout all those bored times that I have a buddy I've known since I was 4 years old. And he said, all that crap you were doing when we were kids somehow wove into your modern life today. So it's weird how all that, I have nothing to do, I guess I'll do this, and your mind coming up with something from nothing to make this so you could be entertained plays into something down the road. There's a lot of bored people right now who are binge watching and doing all these things. Eventually, they're going to get tired of doing those. Well, then do something you would do on your side gig time if you weren't so tired when you got home from work, right? What would you do if you had the energy? Maybe without your job, now you have the energy. That sounds awful. I didn't mean it that way. But you know what I'm saying? That from these terrible kinds of limitations we're under now, there are potential opportunities that some people in lucky situations, right, who aren't caring for a sick loved one, for example. I mean, if you're sitting around bored wondering what to do, this might be something you could take advantage of now. That's a better way to put it.
Truth. And I'm with you on that one. And folks, to Dan's point, do it now because the plants are farming us. They give us oxygen until we decompose and then they consume us. So you got one shot at doing it. What's the old saying, Dan? Everybody is born with two lives and your second life begins when you realize you only have one. I think that this is that moment where we're all starting to get that. Do you mind if we do a couple of questions from the Toronto show?
No. We can do anything. I just don't want you to ever feel compelled to do a Q&A type of format. Please jump in and add or subtract anything you want to after we start talking. Sure. Use it as a jumping off point.
Okay, well, see, there's so when we did the Toronto show, you had a handful of these cue cards, and I think we only were able to get to maybe 5 or 6 questions for you. But some of them
you were awesome there, by the way. I have to just tell the audience, they didn't hear it. You were awesome there, by the way. You're the best questioner I've ever run into ever at one of these things.
Oh, I have you fooled. Dan, I thought you were so much smarter than that, but I'll take the
prove compliments. Me wrong, Jeff. Prove me wrong.
That was a lot of fun. Like, when I'm going to look back on this year in my career, that was the highlight going away.
Remember all the audience thinking I was drinking beer throughout the whole thing?
Well, they gave us beer bottles full of water. And they handed me what I thought was a beer. And I said, no thanks, I don't drink. And they're like, oh, no, this is water. They look like Heineken bottles. And
they so we were sat like Heineken bottles.
Heineken bottles full of water. And I was like, okay, these two guys are getting pickled up there. There's a few questions that I wanted to, you know, I drive home and I get back to my office and I pull these out. I'm like, you know what? I wish I would have looked through these a little more closely because there's some really good ones here. So if you don't mind, Mr. Carlin, I would like to interview you on your podcast. How's that?
It was your idea. Let the audience know. You're the one who came up with this plan.
I just sent Dan a text saying, hey, you know what would be really cool if you just grabbed a bunch of questions from Twitter and did a Q&A on your own podcast. So here we go. This one, going back to the Toronto event from Sean. You tell it in a dramatic, captivating, and succinct way. Whom and what experiences do you credit as influencers of your style?
I got lucky because the times changed on me. I have a vivid memory of a radio station I worked at and meeting my boss at the urinal, you know, when I'm like on a break, the show's in a commercial, run to go to the bathroom, the boss walks right next to me, you know, there's that awkward silence for a minute, you know, never see the boss, and here I am with him here, and I've got to get back upstairs before the break's over, and all of a sudden, out of the silence, as we're both standing there looking up, he says, ever thought about getting your adenoids out? Because those were the days when you wanted to have the big Gary Owens voice, you know, the whole, well, and everybody sounded the same, and I didn't sound like that. So in the time that I was doing radio, the desirable sound of a male broadcaster's voice changed. And all of a sudden, it wasn't about all sounding the same. It was about all sounding distinctively individual. And I was already there, right? I was the guy who needed his adenoids out. Well, fast forward, you know, getting older, whiskey, everything else that comes with age, and my brain slowing down. And I just sound like a less speedy, probably less smart, certainly less quick, a lower voiced version of myself. So it wasn't a style that developed. This is just how I talk. And luckily, the industry came around and made it okay for me to talk this way without surgery.
You know, there was a, you know, mentioning, you know, having a squirt beside a program director. We used to do this segment on this old show that I just referenced with Strombo and Macko called Celebrities I've Urinated Next To. And the most famous person for me, it was late at night at a bar downtown Toronto called Bistro 990 during the film festival. It's like 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And a very inebriated Sean Connery pulled up next to me. So that was my big celebrity. Do you have one, Dan Carlin, the most famous person you've urinated next to?
It wasn't, I don't think it was most famous, but it was certainly most cringeworthy response on my part. So I'm one of these people. I was born in a family where, you know, you ran into famous people pretty often. And so normally I'm pretty good about not losing my mind or anything like that. But there's always a few people, right? Everybody's got, it doesn't matter who you are. Everybody's got a few people where you just lose it. And I was, when I was a kid, I was a baseball fan. And for some reason that is absolutely, I have no connection to the city. I don't know how it ever happened. I was a Baltimore Orioles fan in the 1970s when you know, it was those great teams and everybody else. And the pitcher I liked so much was Jim Palmer.
Great pitcher.
You know, who does a great, great job broadcasting everything today. And when I was a kid, my stepdad, who was in radio also, got me on the field to meet all these guys. I was totally mute. I mean, I was stunned. He said, I've never heard you not talk for like 2 hours. And I couldn't even speak around these people. So I got all their autographs. And I was about 10 or 11 years old or something. So fast forward, I'm working at ABC and they have those morning, the cheesy, well, I guess they're not cheesy. I shouldn't even say they're cheesy, but you know, they had those local LA morning shows with, you know, Tawny Little and Steve, whatever his name was. And they'd have those guys and they'd always have, you know, Evander Holyfield is on or and you know, all the morning stars or whatever. So one day they have Jim Palmer on, but I didn't know it. But I walked into the bathroom down there, got myself a croissant or something off their set, walked into the bathroom down there, and Jim Palmer walks up right next to me at the urinal. And I don't know what I was thinking, because there can't be a more inappropriate time. Maybe like when they're going into surgery is worse. but there can't be a more inappropriate time to say something like, hey, by the way, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I, you know, I want to say to his credit, he was awesome about it, but he wasn't happy. And I understand it totally. He was like, really? Something like that. You know, really? You would do this now? And I was kind of thinking to myself later, I don't know. But now, even, you know, I always say I'm not famous, Jeff, unless I'm at an event that's there specifically for me, right? So I have no ability to know how to behave in those situations. So I did a speaking engagement once at Stanford, and I was there like 15 minutes early, and I said, is there a place I can get some coffee? And they said, oh, yeah, the Stanford place where coffee is right around the corner. So I go there, not thinking at all. I walk in, and the entire place freezes. And it took me a minute to realize that every single person that was going to see me 15 minutes from now was in that coffee place waiting for the thing to start. And I'd walked into one of the few places in the entire world where I was famous. And it got weird right away. It's bizarre right away. And it's not that people aren't cool. It's that I don't know how to behave. Do you know what I'm saying? It's I'm uncomfortable with them being so glad to be around me. You got to treat me more like my wife and kids treat me—a certain level of disdain and impatience and rolling of your eyes for me to be comfortable. People being nice, and I just—but it's funny because it's that same sort of thing where you go, God, if somebody had come up to me in the urinal next to me, would I have even been as nice as Jim Palmer?
But you know what though, at that event that we did at the Hot Dogs Theater, the Ted Rogers Theater, I mean, you were like Beatles come to America when they got off the plane. Like, the place is sold out. I mean, there's a huge lineup for books afterwards. And, you know, a couple of people on the way out, you know, just sort of turned to me and said, I can't believe how, you know, gracious and nice and genuine, like, to every single person. Like, you know, a lot of these events, you know, just grab the stamp and Dan Carlin, thanks for coming. Dan Carlin, thanks for coming. But I mean, Dan, you stayed and talked to everybody, and then the next event was coming on, and you took everybody out in the lobby to talk with them some more and sign more books. Like, was that I don't want to say overwhelming, but was that a unique experience for you, that packed house in Toronto? Were you ready for something like that?
They may be an honorary Canadian citizen, you know, that day, just so you know. And they said it was because of all the apologies I made on stage. They said that obviously I have Canadian blood. Here's the way I looked at it, to be honest, Jeff. I feel like those people, see, normally I'm a person that you don't have to pay to hear. My shows, I mean, we obviously after several years put the archives in a paid area, but I mean, I'm a free guy. So I don't owe you anything. I'm glad you're listening, but I mean, you didn't have to pay anything. Normally I don't have to worry about that. So the Toronto event that we went to was a paid event. I don't do those really. And so these people paid money to come and see me. And I just sort of felt, you feel a little guilty about that because normally I'd be fine. I mean, the podcast is the equivalent of walking in there on stage and just letting anybody come in and sit down. And then if they don't like it or if they want to leave or whatever, I don't feel sort of beholden to them to the same degree I do if they plunk down $12 or whatever it was. So I feel like I felt a real sense of, well, both camaraderie, because it's weird to as a podcaster when you, and you know this too, when you speak into a microphone, you don't see the people on the other end, and it is always I'm not sure the adjective quickly springs to mind. It is an interesting and unique experience to all of a sudden have all these people that you have a relationship with but you've never met together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but you do understand. I mean, you get this as much as anybody else who does podcast. I mean, those are one-on-one relationships that you are creating. You know, as we talked about earlier, radio, you're broadcasting into a car. Television, you're broadcasting into a living room full of people. But podcasts, like, I don't know how many times you have ever said, because I know the number for me is zero, you've ever said, hey, come on, let's all listen to a podcast together. Like, it is a real intimate bond that you form with people. You know, especially when you have something as compelling as you present in either Hardcore or Common Sense. Like, that is a real, like, none of that surprised me. Like, when HarperCollins called me and said, hey, would you like to, we understand you're a big Dan Carlin fan, would you like to host this event? I was like, psh, I hope it's a big theater because I know how popular this guy is and I know how much people love him. Like, that's a real intimate relationship you make in this medium.
You know what, can I circle back to something we talked about earlier when we were talking about people maybe at home, maybe working on some creative idea, not sure what they want to do and all these kinds of things. I don't mean to sound like something out of some pep talk, you know, Tony Robbins, you can do it video. But to hear you say that, Jeff, and to have come from a place where, like you said earlier, when you're talking about the Trent Reznor advice or whatever it was, where it was like, you know, where there's a time where you go, am I doing the right thing? Should I continue to do this? And now looking back on it, saying, you know, having Jeff say that, I'm going, wow, you know, what if I hadn't stayed and done what I did? I mean, I think when you get to the end of your life, whether you're happy with your life or not happy with your life or have mixed feelings about it, I think it's normal for a lot of people to look back on it and go, what if, right? And a lot of times it's, what if I made a better decision somewhere? But I mean, what if I made a worse decision somewhere? Or what if I didn't do this? Or what if I had all these same qualities but lived in a time period that wasn't conducive to podcasting, right? What if it's 30 years ago or 40 years ago? So to hear you say that, it's a unique feeling. I always say that you know, when you get to be my age, I'm 54 now, you see a lot of people who you know, whose dreams have not panned out, whose lives have not gone the way that they would have hoped. And there's a lot of regret that creeps into some people in older age. And if you don't have that, you just feel so fortunate. And you look around and you say, well, why do I not have that? And a huge part of the reason why are those people that showed up to the show in Toronto. The people that listen to the podcast. I mean, I tell them all the time, and it must sound like some sort of just, you know, thing you say at the end of the show. But if not for the collective audience, and much more than, say, a big broadcast network or something like that, if not for the audience, my whole life is different, and not in a good way. So I think about it a lot, actually. And so the relationship between the audience is, I may be speaking in their ear, and I might have a personal relationship with them. But the reason I stay afterwards, and I would have stayed afterwards at that show, whether or not they plunked down the $12, is because I'm aware every day that this life I have is because of them. It sounds cliche, but it's literally true. I mean, we exist on donations and people who buy the old shows. It doesn't get any more personal and connection than that.
There is a real freedom to that, too. I know it tends to be harder work. Like, I work for Rogers, you know, a major, you know, communications company. And you're one of the great independents. And there's a lot of different and harder work that comes along with it. Could you ever see yourself not as an independent?
Well, the first thing I'd like to point out is that I'm not good at a lot of the other stuff that comes with being an independent. And there's a couple of ways you can go. There's a lot of people always want to know about the business that I operate here. And I could have gone the route where you hire a lot of people. There's a lot of work to be done. But if you do that, you become a people manager, and I'm not good at that. What I'm doing here now. See, this is the great thing of working for, say, a radio station or a broadcast outlet. They do all that stuff for you, right? They sell the airtime, they promote the show. They're the infrastructure, and you get to be the tip of the spear that just focuses on what you do. If the infrastructure is not there, you have to provide it, and you have to provide it by hiring people to do it. In which case, you're the boss of a bunch of people, or doing it yourself. A financial advisor told me a while back that we're leaving a lot of money on the table. Well, there's no doubt we're leaving a lot. But I mean, in order to get that money, the things we would have to do would destroy the creative side of what we do here, which is what's both what we enjoy and what makes it good on the listener's end of it, right? So you say to yourself, I'm not going to make as much. I mean, listen, we could do a lot of ads, but I think it spoils, you know, some of the quality of the experience, you know? So, I mean, I feel like, What's the question again? Bring it back to the point for me here, Jeff. We talked about this in Toronto, remember?
We talked about, you know, could you see yourself existing as anything
outside an independent.
Independent? Yeah.
Well, listen, the one thing that I've gotten out of practice of is, and I started to talk about this earlier, and I got off on a tangent where we were talking about collective creative work versus individual creative work when I was starting to talk about the South Park guys and stuff. You know, if you're Jimmy Kimmel or whatnot, you've got a whole huge staff of people, and you've got writers, and everybody's part of the creative contributing staff, right? So you get sort of a creativity by committee. And when it works, you have a Seinfeld, right? Or something really magical. But I find that when I do creativity by committee, me being the persnickety, very specifically weird person I am, I like it less than when it's my own baby, sort of. And so being an independent allows me to not have to do anything I don't want to do. And I don't. We make no allowances at all for anything. At this point, this is the wonderful, you know, we talked about regrets earlier. The wonderful part of my life now is to be able to sit here and go, I don't care about any of this. I'm going to do the show the way I want to do it. If I have some, there's nothing that comes into it other than, here's the way we figure it. We figure that this stuff outlives us, right? The stuff we're making, yep. The stuff you're putting online, this stuff will be around longer than we will. And so we have to live with it. What's more, it's going to be the best representation of who the hell you were when you were alive that you could find. Can you imagine having a podcast of the kind that we do with Hardcore History or Common Sense from any of the great figures in history centuries and centuries ago? Think about how much of their soul would be transmitted. I mean, Cicero, we said earlier, said that writing's the only true form of immortality. Well, think about if it was on YouTube instead. Think about the other nuances of that guy's personality you'd get if you could see him, hear him. You know what I'm saying? It's a three-dimensional transmission of one's soul, personality, and sort of character. And so, I mean, I've often said I feel like my great-grandchildren will get a chance to have a sense of who I was if they simply listen to these podcasts. Now, that boomerangs back, though, when you're doing them and you think about, okay, how much should we tweak this? Or exactly how right does it need to be before we release it and all this? Because you have two audiences. It's like when you're writing a book. You have an audience if you're serializing it in a magazine, right? Chapter 1 in June, Chapter 2 in July, Chapter 3 in August, right? You've got an audience waiting for each of those. That's one audience. But then you have an audience who's not going to find your book for 5 years, right? Who's not going to have to wait for any of it. That's a different audience. So we've got people waiting on the next show for us that are, you know, when's it coming out? When's it coming out? And so we're trying to make a good show for them. But we know that there are going to be people that don't find this for years and years and years. And we have to make a show for them, right? That's they don't care how long it took 5 years from now. They just care how good it is. So these are the kind of things we think about. And to dovetail it with your point about independent versus corporate, can you imagine going to a giant corporation that invested in this and has a publicity staff that's working in line with their promotional side and you know, to get this out of the, you can't do it. They can't function that way. And it's not a slam on them. They have to coordinate the activities of all kinds of people. I have to coordinate the activities of me. And it changes how I approach this creatively and how I can make something that hopefully my grandchildren are happy with, you know?
You know, there was, there is a feeling, and I believe this, that things like music, for example, were at their most vibrant when the people that ran the shops didn't know what they were serving up. When there were the program directors that got a new album across their desk and said, I don't know, maybe the kids will like it, put it on there, let's see what happens. And some of it's crap, as we've heard before, but a lot of it is good when you just admit that, well, I don't know, let's just try something here. You go back and listen to, I'm going to sound like an old guy here, oh, everything was better in the olden days, but if you go back and listen to music in the late 60s and the early 70s, like every song, you know, on any top 30 list, every song was distinct from the very next song. There was a vibration, so many vibrant sounds and different types of music that made its way onto radio. It was fantastic. And then things like, you know, formats got tighter and program directors who thought they knew what the kids wanted became more of a thing. And focus testing, which is still the bane of a lot of radio people's existence. Do you find that you're the kind of person that is more willing to just try things because you don't know? Or, Dan, do you already have this idea of a focus test in your mind before you put it out? You know, William Butler Yeats, one of my favorite poets, used to talk about killing skepticism because in his mind it was the acknowledgement of a limit, and he didn't want to have that with his art. Do you feel similar? Are you the type of person that embraces the let's just try this and see what happens type vibe?
Absolutely. It's one of the reasons the shows take so long. And one of the things I don't ever want to do is have a template for this. I mean, once you say you've got this giant creative white space that we talked about earlier, and once you acknowledge this is something you really like about the medium, well, why do anything that then creates your own boxes that you're then constrained by, right? Radio used to give you those boxes, so you're going to put your own boxes in there. So when I try to figure out how to weave a narrative together, one of the things I ask is this something we do all the time, or is there a way we could switch the, could we tell the end of the story first and then switch it around? So not only does that keep that fresh from a listener's standpoint, it keeps it fresh from a storyteller standpoint and helps you help. I mean, I guess there was a friend of mine, and he's probably going to listen to this, who described what I do, because we used to just do this entirely, like all my shows, I would walk in and record it and we'd be done. And we can't do that with 6-hour podcasts or 3-hour podcasts or whatever. So we started editing them. And I always said that one of the things I didn't like about live talk radio was that, as you know, you're juggling ads and you're juggling news and you're juggling the next guest, and you have 900 things to think about while the caller's talking with you, but then you have to live with whatever political statement then comes out of your mouth over 3 hours, over 15 hours a week, over all those a month. And I used to say, God, I just would love the freedom that an editor has at a newspaper when they write a column to go, oh, that's the wrong word there. Strike that and put the word you really want there, so that when it goes out to the public, you can say, I've signed off on this. This is really what I meant to say. And I feel like the way our podcast developed has given me that freedom. Now, what that does, though, is, you know, and you know this, but the audience maybe doesn't, this is not a scripted program. So my friend, who I was just mentioning, had described what I do as edited performance art. And that kind of is a good way to put it. It's because I get up here and I just sort of riff. I know what I want to say. Usually if it's the history show, I have a couple of quotes usually marked that I want to include. And then as soon as I run out of steam or it starts falling apart, or we tried some experiment and it didn't work or it did work, we cut off for the day and then stitch it to whatever last worked. And then by the end of it, you have a bunch of improvisational sessions that hopefully, you know, tell a story in a way that keeps it fresh and moving. And hopefully, if you've heard a bunch of my shows, doesn't sound like all the other shows, right? Has all the things you like from all the other shows, but keeps you guessing in terms of show design, narrative, the way the story is approached, and all that kind of stuff. So in answer to your question, we experiment all the time, and it is one of the things I like most about the gig.
So let me follow that up then with this question, and this audience member didn't put his or her name on it, but it dovetails your idea about learning. What's the old saying? When one teaches, to learn. Dan, what podcast did you learn the most from?
It's a tough one for me for two reasons. One, when we started podcasting, there weren't all that many podcasts, 2005, June or July 2005. The second reason why is I don't listen to much in the way of podcasting because I'm a reader. I mean, that's what that's my medium, and in part because of the speed at which I read. So conversation often goes too slowly for me, and I live in a place where I don't have this long commute, so my lifestyle isn't conducive to lots of radio or broadcasting. So the podcasting answer is going to be more, I mean, the podcasts that we learned from in 2005 were Adam Curry had the Daily Source Code. I mean, that's an example when you would listen and go, well, what the hell is Adam Curry doing? I mean, but at the stage we were at, you weren't sitting there trying to pick up little tricks. You were sitting there going, now, does he have an email linked to this on a web page? I mean, it was really, really basic stuff you were trying to learn. I remember when people were trying to figure out how to ask for donations and that kind of stuff. We would look at what other podcasters were doing and say, okay, did they put a note on their front page, or are they running ads in their shows? And so it was more trying to get a sense of where the industry was and where trends were moving, rather than, oh, this host had an approach I like, or I like the way that show did intro music. I mean, I feel like in a lot of ways, everything from the imaging to the branding to the show announcer, the buffer, I mean, all that, I think we you know, hoping in a non-arrogant way, but I think we introduced some standards on those things that hadn't been around before. I mean, we brought a big voice in, a friend of mine I've worked with for many years, the great Bill Barrett. And all of a sudden, you know, podcasting sounded like your radio show. And I don't mean we invented that, but that was one of the things that we just said, okay, well, we have access to a big voice. Let's use them. We named all the episodes. So instead of a lot of shows, we're just doing numbers when we started, right? Show number 140. And, the feeling was is that if you name these shows, it's like a Star Trek episode, right? It gives it a personality, and it has a, it's not show 127, it's Trouble for Tribbles, you know, and you go, oh yeah, I know. So we thought the same thing. And then the History Show was the same sort of deal too, where you turn around, you go, that's the idea behind the artwork with the History Shows too. Our wonderful artist, who's Canadian, Nick Lay, said, I think all the shows should have individual artwork for the same rationale that having an individual name was thought of, right? It gives them even more of a personality, even more of a standalone sense of this is a book, right? It's not a podcast where all the shows are the same. This is a piece of art that is a standalone piece of art. And I don't mean the art of the cover or the album art. I mean the entire package wrapped in the art, right? The art in the art. And so when you say, what did you learn from other podcasts? Well, most of what I learned was trying to figure out, and I think they did the same with me. We were all watching each other to try to figure out what's everybody doing, what's the newest thing, what works, what doesn't. I remember when some guy, I don't remember when it happened, one of these podcasts tried to make it, was the first guy that tried to make it a members-only thing, or you have to pay for it thing. And I forgot who it was, but they had a lot of listeners, whatever that time period considered to be a lot of listeners, because it's probably 2006 or 2007. And they went like pay, and everything dried up instantly. And I remember they came back and said, okay, rule number one, don't ask them to pay. But I mean, but nobody knew until somebody tried. So what I learned most was we were watching this develop, and you didn't want to have to learn everything by trial and error yourself. So you kind of watched what everybody else was doing and tried to figure out what was adaptable for you and what wasn't. A lot of what other people were doing wasn't adaptable for our particular style of stuff. But I think everybody watching everybody, that's how the early industry sort of moved forward.
Let me follow up with a question about reading, because you talked about that off the top of that answer. I can recall specifically, because, you know, like you, I was a big reader when I was a kid, always have been. I can remember my mom saying to me once, never make fun of anyone who mispronounces a word, because that means they learned it from a book and didn't just hear it. And we should be encouraging more people to read. How do you talk to your kids about reading?
Well, first of all, that's the kind of statement I can completely get behind, because, you know, when I mispronounce words, that's why I mispronounce them. Thank God the audio pronunciations online are getting so much better. It's easier to work with. It's funny, too, because, Jeff, I always get these wonderful offers from people all around the world to help me with pronunciation if I ever am dealing with anything from their neck of the woods. But it's funny because you go, oh, you know, I had that Japanese guy 5 years ago who told me he'd help me. What are you going to do, find the email, look the guy? It just isn't. So thank God for the audio pronunciation things, because that's been difficult for a lot of History Show people over time. How do I teach my kids about reading? It's a tough one, because I happen to be a person who probably assumes some level of magical power comes from reading. I do think that statement in the world of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. I do think that as less people do things, the people who still do those things become more valuable. There was an interesting book out, Head in the Cloud, I think it was called, something like that, where the author was talking about how important it is to still know things, even in the era where everything is look-upable, and in part because you don't know what you don't know. The reading is the same thing, where I think, and I talked to a guy who said, because he knew I was a big reader, and he said, can't you just get everything a college can give you from reading it yourself? And I said,
Yes and no. You don't know what you don't want to read, though. You don't know what you don't know. And that's what sometimes the professors are there to guide you, right? If they said, here, make sure you read this, well, then maybe yes. But if you're just reading what's interesting to you, you're going to find that your knowledge is somehow limited by that, right? Your choices on what you find interesting have determined the parameters of what you know. You didn't learn what you didn't want to know, and it skewed your image. So when I look at my kids, I'm trying to figure out how much the term reading applies to what they do now. So when you say reading, are we talking about the greats, or are we talking about they're on the iPad and they're, you know, I mean, so I think we have to define, are we talking about the what they're not getting with the great pieces of literature or the ancient classic scholars? Or do you know what I'm saying? That there's all kinds of reading. There's trashy novels and there's Steinbeck. Right. And do you get the same from both of them? So I think all the kids today read a lot. They just are reading little snippets here or there in a digital format. The question is that giving them the benefits that we always associated with? And I'm using air quotes with my fingers, reading.
Is there enough water to the village if you do it that way is what you're saying?
Well, I mean, look, if I'm reading a digital piece on TMZ right now, I'm reading, but did it provide any of the qualities we associate with bettering us as human beings that, you know, when I was a kid, they say, you know, reader's this and reader's that. Well, what if I'm reading the National Enquirer?
See, my kids are 10, 8, and 3, so we try to encourage things that encourage the kids to ask questions. Like, we'll always, okay, so they'll sit down and read, and then we'll sit and talk to them about it and ask them about the questions, just to sort of trigger the idea of, A, questioning things that you read, finding things that are interesting, because that's what I always did when I was a kid, feeling that eventually that type of curiosity in reading will lead to all those things that you talk about. Eventually, if you can understand that, you know, through, you know, even just, you know, reading a book about, like right now my kids are, what are they reading now? I think they're reading the Walking Dead, you know, graphic novel series, but they have a million questions about them. And they'll come to us with like ethical questions about them. And although you can't talk to your kid about utilitarianism when they're 8 years old, those same questions still do exist. So for us, as long as they're still asking questions based on what they're reading, then I think they're heading in the right direction.
I always try when I'm talking about education reform to focus on taking what the child's already interested in and then trying to figure out a way to help them distill value based on what they already find interesting. So, for example, I have a daughter who's not going to like any of those kinds of, who's not going to get into those kinds of questions with you, but she's going to be very interested in the way a story is told. So she's got a very good head for story development and how the pieces fit together, right? Some of the stuff we just talked about with how I like to try to switch it up with our show. So she's got a very good sense of that. So that's when we read, I break the stories down that way. I'll say, well, do you see how the author tried to tell this story this way? And she'll say, yeah, but they could have done this also. And so she's not necessarily getting, she might not be absorbing whatever the message that the writer was trying to get to her was. She's more absorbing the way that the writer decided to tell the story. I read a story about John Belushi once, and I think it was Lorne Michaels, the Saturday Night Live, the Canadian Saturday Night Live a producer who was saying that he was giving John Belushi one of these speeches about cleaning up his act for his health purposes and all that. And he goes, but he'd already heard that story before. He says, when you tell a comedian like that, something like that, they're more probably trying to work out an impression of you and how you raise your eyebrow and how your voice talks and all that sort of stuff, instead of hearing the content of the message. Well, my daughter wasn't hearing necessarily what that writer was trying to impart in terms of data and story and information, but she was paying close attention to the way the eyebrow went up and the tone of the voice and the way the story was told. So in answer to your question, I try to find out what it is that they're finding appealing from the work, and then I try to examine that. I wrote a piece once for Edutopia, which is it's an education reform online resource. And I didn't want to write it because a lot of teachers use it, and I didn't feel qualified to tell teachers how to teach. They're in the classrooms every day. So I try to just say,
isn't it silly to teach kids a bunch of things if they don't remember it later? Because the whole idea behind teaching, say, names and dates is it's important stuff for a citizen to know these things. But it doesn't matter if they don't retain that knowledge. And so I was trying to point out that maybe if you started with the fact that we're all interested in history innately, but just not the same history, you find out what your kid likes, and then you teach them the history of that, right? They like hockey. Hockey has a history. They like fashion. Fashion has a history. You can teach how, you know, historical evolution and historical processes and all these things by sticking with the subject the kid already likes. And so when we talk about books and my kids, they aren't necessarily getting, you know, you could say, here, read this book, you'll learn a lot, kid. But they might learn a lot. It just might not be what you think they should learn. So I try to craft what works in the piece with what the child, what resonated with the kid. Does that make sense?
It does. And there's actually a follow-up, another question here that sort of follows that up. Again, from someone unknown, they didn't write their name. Dan, I have a 3-year-old daughter. I can't yet play her your podcast. What do I do until I can? How can one gradually or best introduce children to history?
Again, I think this is something that you tailor to the personality of the individual. That's why we all choose, if you go to a history section at a bookstore, if there are any old brick and mortar bookstores left or in the future, different people are going to pick different books. It's all history, but different. I mean, for a while, one of my kids was interested in the life of pioneer women on the frontier in the middle of the United States. And she was really taken with their stories. So she'd read these novels or these pieces that would include a lot of the primary sources where you'd hear, you know, what it was like growing up in Little House on the Prairie type situations. And that resonated with her. And so you find something, you go, well, if you like that, you might like this. All you're trying to do there is awaken a love of the past. And this is what I said in the education article. If you can manage to turn that spark on, if you could appetize someone for the love of history, they still may not know what year Columbus discovered the New World from the Old World, but they will be continually reading historical things, be interested in it, and they will begin to fill in. This is what I always hope to do. You start to fill in broad areas of knowledge. Oh, before our own time, you had this era. And then before that era, you had this era. And so you begin to form a framework for how the broad eras of humanity have fit together. But you have to do it like a jigsaw puzzle. And when you're talking about your kids, you start with whatever piece of the puzzle first is attractive to them.
That is, you know, my parents did that with me in one very specific way, Dan. Every year, at least once or twice, this is before, obviously, you know, the internet and, you know, they have various books about hockey. But as a kid, I was always fascinated with hockey, still am to this day. They would take me to the Hockey Hall of Fame in downtown Toronto and leave me there. I had a notebook and my little knapsack. Geez, Dan, I was 8, 9 years old, and I would write everything down. I would sit there and watch all the videos and make notes, and I'd come back with my notebook all filled up with observations and just regurgitation of facts that I knew about hockey. And honestly, afterwards, I would start to ask questions about what was happening around the games that weren't just the games. Who are these guys? Where did they go? What was the circumstance? Why didn't they play this game? Why did this person get arrested? Different things like that. So I can, from personal experience, that's how my parents did it with me. Now, maybe they just thought the Hockey Hall of Fame was going to be the world's cheapest babysitter. I don't know. But they would just plunk me down at the Hockey Hall of Fame, and I would stay there the entire day. I got one more for you. This is a really interesting one. How does our tendency to gloss over the carnage, gore, and unforgivable aspects of history affect how we interpret our past?
Well, obviously, we do the opposite on the Hardcore History program. We don't gloss over it. You know, I think it's an interesting question because I would argue that we don't gloss over it. We zoom in and zoom out in a way that gives us quick hits of the nastiness without any of the long-term contemplation that you would hope comes with it, right? So if you look at at both world wars, any major events like that, you'll see that there's a period of almost like international reflection afterwards. where everyone sorts of think they're trying to absorb the enormity and the lessons and all everything of what just happened because it's so fresh and so enormous. I think that there may be almost an evolutionary self-defense mechanism that allows us over time, if not to forget that, then to not feel it at the same levels of intensity. I mean, imagine if human beings still felt with the same intensity all of the great, you know, traumatic events of history. You don't, over a couple of generations, it fades. And that may be like a protective measure, right, to allow us to move forward unburdened by all of the trauma of the collective past. But, of course, it comes with the downside, too, which is without the trauma and without it being fresh in your mind, that contemplative reform period, that period where you say, what did we learn from this? Let's make sure this never happens again. That fades too. I was talking to somebody the other day. We were talking about a line, I forgot where I heard it, but it's about the smell of the bodies. And we're talking about the concentration camps at the end of the Second World War, where some of the Allied generals made some of the local Germans from the nearby town walk around the camp with all the dead bodies out. And there's film of this, by the way. And one of the generals had said something like, you know, I want them to smell the bodies. I want them to remember the smell of the body, something like that. And so that became almost like a term that you use to say, when the smell of the bodies is fresh, we're in one frame of mind. But after a couple of generations, when you don't smell the bodies anymore and you don't remember them and you didn't know those people and they're not even real to you, it's almost like, okay, well, the contemplative and reform side that came as a result of the smell of all those bodies also seems to fade. So, you know, one might say that they're, you know, when the person who asked the question was asking, he's basically sort of asking, isn't he? How can we maintain the benefits that come when somebody smacks humanity in the face with something like a world war long afterwards? And I don't know the answer to that. That's the old line about people forgetting history, right?
It seems as if, as well, my buddy Bob phrased it to me the other day like this. It's like trying to do a Rubik's Cube that fights back. It's a wonderful line. Or it's like playing a game of cards where every 2 minutes a new deck is introduced. You've talked a couple of different times in a couple of different places about this idea that history doesn't teach us what we think it can. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, sure. Because I think everybody winces when they hear somebody trying to say something like, well, 1938 at Munich teaches us you can't appease dictators or something like that, because that's exactly what history doesn't teach us. That's exactly the line that somebody had once said about it being like a river where you can put your toe in the river and it's the same river, but it's not the same water, right? And it's not the same water at the same place at the same time. What I always say about the Hitler analogy is what 1938 really teaches you is you can't appease that dictator at that time over that subject. So it really doesn't teach you much of anything. But what history does seem to teach us is certain things involving, for example, the herd stuff. So we talked earlier about how we're all reacting humanity-wise to what we're facing now with the coronavirus, and that some of that stuff was that if I brought anything in the recent book I wrote to the table, it's certainly not the Nostradamus-like prediction about a coronavirus, because all the experts were predicting that. It's about how people behave once they have a threat of a virus, though. So the 1938 analogy doesn't work, but it does teach us the herd stuff, right? The stuff like we were talking about in the book, the Nostradamus type thing. It's not Nostradamus to predict a COVID virus. That's coming. It's predicting how we're all going to react. And truthfully, we reacted a little like you'd expect a mass group of humans to react, whether it's the 21st century or the 10th century. So I found that to be something where you could say, okay, history doesn't teach us how to behave in any given situation, but history shows us how large groups of us might behave in certain situations. And so I think it's a little bit less about specific lessons and a little bit more about big picture, broad trend reactions, if that makes sense.
Dan, we started this conversation by me asking you about the title of your book, The End is Always Near. If you release this book now, as opposed to last fall, would chapter 6 be chapter 1?
I'm not sure chapter six, and that's the pandemic prologue chapter. I don't know if it would be in the book at all. It's one of those things where you look at it now and you would almost say, well, why would you put that here? Right? I mean, it's almost like we understand. It's only interesting to me because it hasn't happened. It doesn't... I would suggest that if I wrote the book today, that probably wouldn't even be in there because you would sit there and go so often, you know, well, what's the... I mean, we know, right? I'm asking about all these science fiction-like things that might happen during a pandemic, and you're sitting here going, it's not science fiction. I'm doing it now. One guy wrote me an interesting line. It was on Twitter, I think, where he said, I thought you were jumping the shark when you said that, you know, would society shut down again with a modern pandemic, and yet here we are. But I'm as surprised as everybody. I didn't say this. I asked it, right? So I was asking a bunch of questions throughout the whole book. There's no answers. It's a bunch of questions. So when you ask a bunch of questions about what if a pandemic happened, and then a pandemic happens, it's almost like, well, why would I put those questions in the book? That chapter's moot.
One final one from me. The themes that you tend to talk about a lot, end of the world, technological regression. What interests you right now, Dan, as we record this podcast? What is top of mind outside of pandemic, which is on the top of everybody's mind, certainly? What else interests Dan Carlin right now?
I think, like a lot of Americans, I'm watching the political situation. I think that's something that that has become so unpredictable that I think it's hard to take your eyes off of it very long and focus on other things. So I would say that right now, and obviously this is highlighted by the situation we're in, but if you recall, before this situation, we had a not as significant, but another significant crisis. So I feel like even if you want to focus on other things right now, at least in the United States, but I would imagine worldwide, your attention is drawn away from those things towards the bigger show going on right now. Maybe that's a way to put it.
Dan, you're the best at this. How do we end this one on a positive note? I'm out of cue cards from the Hot Docs event.
You know, somebody was saying to me the other day, I was having a conversation with somebody the other day, and we were talking about worst case scenarios. And they were saying that they thought the worst case scenario would be when somebody did something really drastic, right? Terrorism, or somebody bombed something, or just some big awful thing. And I said, yes. I said, that does sound pretty darn bad, and you might be right. I said, although we should understand something, that there's another way it can go when that happens, right? The other way it could go is that it's like a slap in the face towards society. So let me use the example of the late 1960s, early 70s, and what was called the New Left back then, and what became the edge of the violent left back then, the Weather Underground, those kind of people. When SDS went to the Weather Underground, or when the Symbionese Liberation Army was running around and all these things, those people took the political rhetoric of the time, which seemed pretty extreme, to the logical conclusions and started planting bombs. When we had hundreds of bombings in a couple of years, the average Americans, who might have been some of them anyway, open to some countercultural message. Remember the John Lennon line? You know, if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't going to make it with anyone anyhow.
Yeah.
There was something about, hey, man, right on, this all sounds great, the revolution and all that. But when people are getting bombed, a lot, it could go the other way, too. Like we said, the burning of the Reichstag enables Hitler and you have the Nazis. You can go that route, too. But it can also go, wait a minute now, time to get real here, right? That has a way of waking up the ballast of society, or is, what did Nixon call them? The silent majority. Does this mean the silent majority? We just have to just wait for a good terror attack and all this will be over? Of course not. You could have the Reichstag burning thing we just mentioned. But for your silver lining here, there is a possibility that the way you get a correction is when something goes too far. So if something goes too far, that would be called looking at the bright side.
I don't want to tell you how to do your podcast, Dan, but that is a perfect line to end it.
A thousand thanks to my friend Jeff Merrick for being willing to do this, not once, but twice for me. Check out his work on Rogers Communications Sportsnet. You can also find his stuff. He's the co-host of the 31 Thoughts podcast. He's an awesome guy. And if you're Canadian, you don't need me to tell you about Jeff Merrick. You probably heard about me from Jeff. In any case, he's a wonderful guy. Enjoy him a lot, and hopefully we can do this again and make it a trifecta at some point. Also, just a little update on Supernova progress. I'd say more than two-thirds of the way done. Sorry for the wait, but you know how I roll. I got multiple feeds, and I like to put out just a trickle of content out on each one of them. You've heard of trickle-down economics. This is trickle-out podcasting, and we are just, you know, reverting to form here. I should point out just a little announcement. If you ever want to find out where the shows are in terms of, you know, when we release them and make sure you're on, we do have a Twitter feed at Hardcore History, and we make sure that anytime we put anything out, we announce it there. So you'll never miss a show release. Also, if you've had any problems accessing the paid archives, and for those who don't know, we keep the recent shows up free for years. And then after several years, we move them to the paid archive, and you can get them off our website or iTunes or some other places. And apparently we had an OS update that broke something that we didn't know about on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. So if you've had problems getting shows recently, that should be fixed. And I wanted to make sure we thanked you all, because you telling us about it helped us to find it. So once again, we're like a little community here. And I do want to say that as a little community here, it's a little weird during this whole period we're living in right now, this whole coronavirus era. I feel like we're getting, I feel like that line, you know, the end of history, or sort of a respite from history that they used to say about geopolitical concerns after the Cold War and before the 9/11 attacks. I think that kind of applies to us now in a germ virus disease kind of sense, maybe. Like, all of a sudden, we're getting the tiniest little taste of what it was like. We probably deal with it differently, but what it was like to live in fear of communicable diseases in a way we haven't done in a while. That's a crappy way to have some empathy with people in the past, isn't it? It's also a weirdly human thing to kind of almost need something like this to remind us that we're all in this together, isn't it? I mean, do you have to have a world war to create national unity? Do you have to have a coronavirus to remind us that we're all connected? I don't know. But I'll tell you what, I never feel disconnected from you folks. I feel, you know, it's funny because everybody's lives have been totally put upside down, and I'm still working the way I always do. And because my life is not disrupted as much as most people's, I constantly am thankful for the fact I'm able to do this, and that's all your fault. So thank you. I hope you're all doing okay. And we're going to, you know, ease out of this thing, I think, together. Stay safe, everybody. And you know, we'll be trickling out our content to you at our normal torrid pace in the near future.